Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. You ain't going to be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economic. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pools in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for at least. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations who got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75, 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. And so you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You know, you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marching, they never changed anything.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
But you say, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Curtis Stone, and I'm an urban farmer. I run a farm called Green City Acres, and we grow organic salad greens, microgreens, cherry tomatoes, baby root vegetables, and some herbs in urban lots that we don't own that we sell to nearby grocery stores and restaurants. The total productive size of our urban farm is a quarter acre spread out amongst five urban lots. I'm standing in one of them right here. This is my neighbor's house, and right next door is the home base of our farm. This farm can generate over $100,000 in gross revenue per year, growing year-round, but predominantly that's generated in 8 months with two people working full-time and then part-time during the four winter months. Today I'm going to give you guys a tour of the whole farm, some of the tools and techniques that we use to achieve what we do. We're going to start right here at the home base, then I'm going to show you how and what we grow, and then give you a tour of the rest of the farm. Here we go. Starting here at my home base, this is where I live and where I do most of my work. The house on the left of the two greenhouses is mine. I own it, at least I have a mortgage on it, and it is solar powered. It's got a 11.5 kilowatt solar system there. For the most part, we do, I would say, 80 to 90% of the work on the farm is done here at the home base. We actually spend most of our time in post-harvest, and I'll talk a little bit about more of that as we go through this. But I live here, I've got a home office there, passive solar greenhouse that is based on a passive solar design. It's not entirely passive, but it is our nursery, and we do microgreens in there year-round, as well as all of our nursery starts. And that big greenhouse in front of it is a hothouse. It's a double poly greenhouse that we can do tomatoes in it really early. It's got a 6,000 kilowatt heater in it, which is powered by the solar on my house. And we can do really early stuff in the ground or push things really late in there. So really the name of the game here is using every square foot we can for production. The front yard of my house is 1,100 square feet. So those are about, so the majority of them are 40 foot beds, and there's a couple short ones in there. And each of these beds will be rotated at least four times a season with quick growing crops. That is mostly what we specialize in on our farm. Another way we can really push our season far into winter and starting really early in the spring is with these modular greenhouses called caterpillar tunnels. They can be put up and taken down really quickly. About one guy can put up a 50-foot tunnel in about an hour, maybe with a bit of help to put the plastic on. But these greenhouses really allow us to push our season. We even put one in the front yard of our house this spring. Mind you, it was only there for 6 weeks. It was there to serve the purpose to get the crop started and established, and then it came down. So these greenhouses have become a critical part of the season extension infrastructure on our farm. And in fact, we put them on our other plots as well. This plot here and here both had two caterpillar tunnels on them just this spring, and we plan on putting them out in the fall to go into the winter again this season. So this is one of the most important areas on our farm. This is our post-harvest area. This is where we wash and spin and dry everything. And over here is where we pack orders. Toby is here just packing some greens for grocery stores. I do our label printing from this computer, which prints off on this little printer here. And then this printer is for printing invoices. So that's how we're completing all of our orders once they've been washed. We reuse wax cardboard boxes that we get from the back of the grocery stores that we sell to. We pick those up when we drop stuff off, so we just reuse them. So back over here, the walk-in coolers are probably one of the most critical pieces of infrastructure on our farm. These are two restaurant-style walk-in coolers. They're 4 feet deep, 6 feet wide, and 6 feet tall. And both of these have been modified with a CoolBot system, which is essentially a modified air conditioner, and it's an inexpensive way to set up a compressor for produce. I will say that they are generally better for smaller coolers, and if you're going to have a big cooler, you might need to have a couple air conditioners with a couple CoolBots. But this infrastructure over here is critical. This is a washing table. We wash root veggies on here, and I've done videos on all this stuff. If you just use the search on my channel, you can find out all these individual things. So this is a bubbler. That's for bubbling or washing greens. It shakes the dirt off with water. It works with a jacuzzi pump. These are our salad spinners. They are modified washing machines to wash and spin our salad greens, or to spin our salad greens, just to say. And this is our greens drying screen. Again, I've mentioned all this stuff in my book, but I've done many videos on this before. Now, this is our main tools wall. So these are tools that are used constantly, multiple days a week, almost all year. The quick cut greens harvester, that's a revolutionary tool that we use for harvesting most of our salad greens except lettuce. That is a tilther, which is a shallow tiller, essentially. That is a Jang seeder, that's our main planting tool. This is a flame weeder, which we use a lot for bed prep. Here's all of the seed that I use on a weekly basis. This is for the Jang seeder. These are the rollers for the Jang seeder. They have different types of rollers to drop different types of seed, and that's all the seed that I'm using on a constant basis, like red Russian kale, arugula, spinach, radishes and turnips and things like that. This is what I call my secondary tools wall. It's just around the corner. And these are all the hand tools that we use on the farm. So I've also done a video on these tools specifically. You can check that one out in the video card above. That is the paper pot transplanter. That is a game-changing tool for us on the farm. And this is the BCS. This is a BCS walk-behind tractor, two-wheel tractor. We have a rototiller on the front, but I also use a rotary plow for it. And this is the machine that can have the implement called a power harrow, which is a way of doing shallow till for your bed cultivation, which reduces weed pressure and keeps your soil more intact. So this is the hybrid passive solar greenhouse. A lot of production here in the other 10 months of the year, and nothing in it during the 2 months that are the hottest months. So I've got a shade cloth on here. Lots of circulation fans in this greenhouse. We have an exhaust fan here and an air intake on the other side of the greenhouse. The greenhouse is also heated during the coldest times with a 6,000 watt heater here. All of this stuff is connected to the solar of my house. This greenhouse has what's called a climate battery. And so this duct pulls hot air from the top of the greenhouse in the center and it pumps it down through this fan underground. And so 3 feet beneath my feet, we have big O piping running every 6 inches underneath the floor here, about 3 feet under. And we pump the hot air underground and the floor will radiate heat throughout the winter. And it is it's basically why they call it a climate battery, because it holds the climate and creates some passive heat in this greenhouse. So yes, I do heat it when it needs to be heated, but even on its own, it can stay above freezing, even in the coldest times of the winter. During the winter, we have to run a dehumidifier, and that's what that is. We also bring one of our walk-in coolers in here in the winter, and we do all of our post-harvest and packing in this greenhouse during the winter as well. And even a little bit beyond the winter, we'll actually do our post-harvest stuff in here up until late April, just because it's nice, comfortable, and warm. And we've got lots of space in here to do that. This is the shade house. This is the summer nursery on the farm. So in the summertime, I don't want to have microgreens and nursery stuff in the greenhouse or nursery because it gets too hot. And I have to go and hand water every 2 hours. Whereas with this setup, it's automatically irrigated with misting irrigation. It comes on every 6 hours. And it's more than enough to handle all the watering of these plants and microgreens consistently, and it also saves me a lot of stress and time. That's a 60% shade cloth above, and I've just attached it to my neighbor's fence. It's a temporary structure, and it's just up for the 2 months of summer. This is one of our bikes and trailers. We used to do everything by bike and trailer, but now we mostly use a truck. This is a Dodge ProMaster City. We still use the bikes to go back and forth between the plots for little things, but this is our main delivery vehicle. So the vast majority of the product that we sell now goes to grocery stores in Kelowna. So these are five different chains in Kelowna: Nestor's Market, Choices Market, and Quality Greens. And you can see by the products there, we're fairly specialized. We've got some cherry tomatoes there, some carrots, and then various bags of salad greens. That's essentially what our farm produces now. We're about down to 10 different products that we grow. I started with 90 different vegetables, where I've grown 90 in the course of my career, and I've just kept doubling down on the things that provide the most value or the greatest return in the least amount of time, and that has been salad greens, microgreens, and cherry tomatoes during the main season. But for the most part, it's salad greens and microgreens that we're doing almost year-round.
The name of the game with our production on our farm is high-rotation planting. Now, this is a term that I coined and I wrote about in my book, The Urban Farmer. And what this means is that all of the plots of land that we farm, all the ones you saw in this video, each bed is rotated on average 4 times per season, and it's primarily growing quick-growing crops. So I'll explain some of the characteristics of the crops that we grow in a minute. But each of these beds are rotated 4 times a season. On average, a 50-foot bed on our farm will generate $1,600 of revenue through the course of a season. In order to do that, these crops have to have some certain characteristics. So economically, a 50-foot bed can generate $1,600 of revenue. We have the equivalent of 63 50-foot beds on our farm. 63 times 1,600 is $100,000, $800. So that's a benchmark on what we can achieve on our farm. It's not a guarantee, but it's a benchmark. When I'm looking at the season and looking what we can do, I can use that as sort of a frame of reference as to what I think we can achieve. I've been doing this for 8 years now, and all the numbers that I write about in my book are based on data that I've recorded every year that I've been farming, and I've arrived at these benchmarks by just tracking my information over the years. So the really important thing here is the types of crops we grow. So there's five characteristics of the crops that we try to focus on our farm, and these characteristics I find are the most important and the most telling on whether a crop is going to be profitable for us. The first thing is popularity. The crop has got to be in demand. People have to know what it is. The second thing is days to maturity. We're only growing crops that have 60 days or less to maturity. So there's no corn, there's no cabbage, there's no potatoes, there's no onions, there's no garlic, there's no winter squash. I might grow that stuff in my private garden, but I'm not growing that on the farm. The third thing is high yield. I'm looking for crops that will deliver at least half a pound per linear foot in bed. So I want it on a 50-foot bed, I want to get at least 25 pounds per harvest of a crop. So that could be greens, that could be radishes when I crop them out, you name it. The fourth thing is high price. I'm generally targeting crops that have a high price point. I'm targeting around $4 a pound or more. Some crops I grow aren't quite that much, but the vast majority of them are at least that and much more. So we're not growing low value crops like corn and winter squash. Again, it's about higher value crops. That's how we're making a good living on a small land base. And the fifth thing is long seasonality. I'm not growing crops that have a short season. So for example, melons, you might plant them in May, but you don't harvest them until August. Salad greens, all the types of crops you see behind me, maybe basil would be one exception, I can have them for almost 8 months of the year. That means I have a very long season to market in, and that's what makes these crops profitable. So those five characteristics are what I'm targeting when I'm picking crops to grow on our farm and how I'm going to make these tiny lots as profitable as they are.
Now, to get this kind of production out of our beds, we amend with high amounts of organic matter, primarily compost and manure. We start each season by applying 2 inches of compost to each bed. Then, each subsequent planting after that gets an application of organic composted turkey manure, which is an 8-4 NPK rating. We sometimes apply another 2 inches of compost during the peak summer if we feel the beds could use it. Altogether, we only spend $2,000 a year on our fertility. We also make our own compost, but it isn't nearly enough to meet our intensive needs. It's also worth mentioning that most of the crops we grow are actually very low feeders. So just to give you guys an idea of some of the production we get from the crops that we grow, here's some examples of four common crops we grow. Red Russian kale is a salad green we do, pretty much grow it year-round. On the first cut, you get around 40 pounds, second cut, 15, third cut, 10, something like that. So you're getting, you know, 65 pounds on a bed. Spinach is a really good one, 50 pounds on the first cut, 30 on the second, 20 or so on the third, still get around 100 pounds on one bed. Arugula, now that's a really profitable one for us, and it grows so fast. It grows fast in the spring, but in the summer it grows in like 21 days from seed to harvest. So you get around 40 pounds on the first cut, then you get 15 on the second. Sometimes we don't even wait for the second cut in the summer. We just pull it out immediately and then plant something else, you know, a 21 day crop. So we can sell that anywhere up to $6 to $10 a pound. Same for all these greens, actually. Now, Salanova, that's our biggest one. This one's done as a transplant. It's not planted in the same way that the others are. It's not direct seeded. So we actually have to harvest it by hand. We can't use the quick cut greens harvester on it. And huge yields on this bed. I mean, on average, at 100 pounds per bed, you know, 50 pounds on the first cut, 35 on the second, 15 on the third. We can sell that at around the same price point. Sometimes we get 80 pounds on the first cut of Salanova if we let it get big enough. The cool thing about the crop is that the leaves stay small. As the head gets bigger, the leaves don't get big, so it's really consistent as far as putting it in a salad mix. So you can see, even with all those, just those four together, if you would have had a four-crop bed in succession with all four of those crops, your total would have been massive. You know, you would have been around $3,000 of crop in one bed. So So besides the farm home base that you've seen, I don't own any of the land that we farm in. We lease it out from homeowners in exchange for vegetables. So it actually costs us no cash, technically. We will take over a person's backyard, and we generally want the whole backyard, or as much as we can get, at least 1,000 square feet. And we grow vegetables in it for a growing season. And for that growing season, we will give the landowners a basket of veggies each week that we deliver to them. So that basket of veggies is worth around $20 to $30, depending on the season. And we take all the labor of maintaining a lawn off them. You know, a lawn is essentially a cost center. It doesn't really produce anything for you unless you play soccer a lot or something. But we also take care of the water bill. So any of the water use that exceeds their normal household usage, we compensate them.
Thanks for watching, guys. If you want to learn more about this stuff and how I do it, make sure to subscribe to my channel. If you really want to take it to the next level, you can come to one of my live events. I do workshops throughout the US, New Zealand, on my farm, and abroad. Or you can sign up for my online course, which is a 10-week self-study, fully comprehensive small farming multimedia encyclopedia. I will have all the links below in the show notes, as well as at the end of this video regarding that information. All right, guys, talk to you later. Hey guys, today I want to introduce you to Brian Bates of Bear Creek Organic Farm. This video you're going to see today is a series of edits from the original interview I did with him that I posted at fromthefield.farm last week. That video is an hour and 42 minutes long, and it's long form interview and tour of the farm. These guys are absolutely crushing it. Brian has an entrepreneurial attitude that is similar to what you might see in venture capital or tech. The guy is a true entrepreneur, and he doesn't think like a farmer. And I don't mean that to degrade farmers, because I'm a farmer too. But the way he thinks about systems and his business is unlike most growers that I know. He is truly an entrepreneur, and he thinks big, and he's scaling his business. These guys they're on less than 3 acres of land. In fact, last year they were only on two, and they did $410,000 in gross revenue. Now, that really only leaves about 10% profit, but they pay all of their employees $40,000 a year. So the crew is paid very well, and he runs this like a business. And there's five things I've identified that I want to go over right now before I just kind of leave it to Brian. But there's five things that I've identified that he does that make them successful. The first thing is they focus on
relatively high value crops. Now, it's a fairly large farm as far as market gardens are concerned. It's just under 3 acres now of production. And they grow things like garlic and tomatoes. But the bread and butter does come from their microgreens and their salad greens. And Brian will kind of get into the details of those. The second thing they do is they have fairly low maintenance and scalable market streams. And this is because they've focused on retail markets and they're not having to go and sell all the stuff at farmers markets. They're in market streams where they can leverage their brand power to scale the customer demand in all the stores that they're in. And they're in a small community. Petoskey, Michigan is, I think it's like 6,000 people. It's a tiny, tiny area. And they're just moving this much product in retail. That's amazing. The third thing is they're doing year-round production. This is a totally high tunnel-based operation that is doing a lot of these crops year-round, particularly the microgreens and also the salad mixes and greens that they have in those high tunnels. The fourth thing is they pay the crew very well. So they're each getting $40,000 a year. And some people might say, oh, well, that's a way to kill the business if you're paying people that well. Well, what I saw when I was there is a real consolidated team effort. You've got people that feel a sense of ownership on the farm, and I think that creates a synergy on their farm that allows them to do things that many others wouldn't do, in the sense that only the owner would feel the responsibility to take on certain tasks. But Brian's got his crew doing all this. And yeah, there's pros and cons to that, and he'll talk about that, but that's the fourth thing. The fifth thing, probably the most important thing here, is they're running this like a business. Brian says this many times throughout the interview, but he really takes this seriously, and he thinks about it a lot differently than most farmers, in the sense that they take on loans. I think they were putting in another $400,000 of infrastructure just this year on the farm. They're scaling this puppy, and they're really going for the gold. And you don't see that in farming that often. So those are the five things. And, you know, I've visited a lot of market gardens over the years, and I have to say, these guys are the number one that I've seen as far as how you can scale a business, how you can grow a market garden. And there's no benefactor here. Like, they're getting loans just like any other small business would. They're self-funding this, and they're letting the market guide where they go. And that's what I really liked about Brian's approach, was his totally market-driven approach. Amazing stuff. You're going to see it in this video, but Brian was the first person I'd seen do this Pac-Man style planting with Salanova, with the paper pot transplanter, where they basically plant a bunch of rows with no walkways, and then you harvest it and you walk on what you harvested. Brian was the first one to do that, and he demonstrates that in this video. There's a ton of value in this short video, but if you are a member at FromTheField.Farm, make sure to watch the 1 hour and 42 minute long interview I did with Brian last week. All right, guys, enjoy. Like, I'm very surprised to see what I did when I came in here. All these microgreens, like, as you describe the place that you're in and the demographic you're dealing with, you're moving a lot of product.
A lot.
That is fairly niche market product in a marketplace that I would not expect. Did you, when you were setting this up, did you have to do a lot of education to your customers to get people on board? Because quite frankly, I'm surprised that you've had this much success and you're moving this much production this early in the game, like only 6 years in.
Uh-huh.
How did you find these customers? Are there a bunch of greenies that live around here that are into this? Or
so? We run a very market-driven farm, so we were not like, we're going to build a farm around lettuce and tomatoes and microgreens and people are going to buy it and we're going to educate them until they buy it. That's not our approach. We had never heard of microgreens when we started our farm, but we wanted to start plants earlier in this greenhouse, and we thought, man, the propane bill is really expensive to start tomatoes, for which you don't see a crop until July.
Yeah.
So we were like, maybe there's something we can grow that's a little faster.
Yeah.
And we were at a farmer's market in the winter in Wisconsin, and they were selling microgreens at the farmer's market. Okay? At this point, we'd heard of microgreens, but as this really fancy niche crop, you know, fancy chefs, high-end restaurants. But these folks were selling microgreens, like, straight to their customers. And we thought, well, that's interesting. They're selling what we consider a fancy crop to regular customers. And it wasn't dramatically cheaper. It was still pretty expensive. But this sort of light bulb went off. Now, I will say a light bulb went off. My wife will say she's been telling me this for years. That two versions to every story. She's probably, you know, she's probably mostly right on that. But I was just like, there's no market for it.
Yeah.
The mental switch was we thought we were going to grow. And we started with two flats. Two flats a week. Bring them to market. Cut them at market. Get people trying it. Four flats.
Yeah.
Eight flats. By the end of the first year, we were seeding like 60 flats a week. Now we'll seed 600 flats a week in the summer. Okay, so, but it's important. You know, I see a lot of people getting in the microgreens game. We did not start with 600 flats. We did not start thinking this greenhouse would be full of microgreens.
Yeah.
We started with two flats of buckwheat, because which we don't even grow anymore.
Yeah.
Like, it seemed like a good one. So we started small, and the big shift was we thought we'd be marketing it as, like, super nutritious, this, like, super food marketing. And our customers were like, yeah, that's cool, but, like, there's kale and spinach, too. And the shift was, it's convenience. It's convenience food.
Yeah.
You made your whole dinner for you and your family. You forgot to add a salad or a vegetable. Put some microgreens on it.
Yeah.
You were making a sandwich for lunch real quick. You've just got some deli meat, some mayo. Put some broccoli micros on it. And so all of a sudden, you know, we started encroaching on, like, people who are already buying Sprouts and talking, singing the praises of microgreens compared to Sprouts. And then also just, like, if you're already eating baby greens, saying, look, we can't realistically have a great selection of baby greens for 4 months of winter, but we can do microgreens. And so then we started marketing this as just, like, basically, like, really tiny salad mix.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so the vast majority, and I'm saying in terms of pounds sold, probably 75% of our microgreens are going to individual customers.
That's amazing.
Not chefs. About half of our sales are to grocery stores now. Talking to you now,
yeah.
Almost 50% of our sales are to grocery stores.
Okay.
And so we are selling these in individual, you know, 2 ounce containers to the grocery store.
Yep.
And then 30% of our sales is at farmers market. We attend two farmers markets a week, Friday and Saturday, for 4 hours each, 52 weeks a year.
Yeah.
So we go to the two markets year round. That's 30%, 50% grocery, 30% farmers market. And then we do about 10% with restaurants,
mm-hmm.
and across the whole year. So it's way more in the summer, barely anything in the winter. And then the other 10% is our plant sale, like our like
yeah.
garden, you know, starts and stuff in the spring, which is just a 2.5 week flash sale in our greenhouse. People come out, buy all their organic plants, go home and garden with them, and so it's like 2.5 weeks.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's really cool.
It's an insane 2.5 weeks. You know, our town is 6,000 people. It's not a big area.
So who's your guys' market then?
Yeah. Basically our neighbors. Yeah, so unlike so many market farms that we looked at and like learned from and worked on or whatever, a lot of them were a small farm on sort of the urban or suburban fringe selling into a large area. I'm thinking like Twin Cities, Madison, Wisconsin, Chicago, you know, Philadelphia, like all these sort of, you're outside selling in.
Yeah.
And our town is 6,000 people. Our county is 30,000. So we're not pulling from a huge amount of people. We are in a summer tourist destination.
Yeah.
So there's a bunch of people that come up, you know, up north for the summer. So we have, like, restaurant accounts in the summer that buy things that no restaurant would buy up here in the winter.
I see.
They are doing higher-end short-term cuisine, and then they shut down.
Yeah.
So there's this sort of brief moment. But also, we're in a very cold climate.
Yeah.
And so that's why we've doubled down on greenhouses and hoop houses, because we figure those are never going out of style. We have a very cold climate, and so being able to have that jump start on spring and grow things when people sort of expect it a little less often makes a big difference.
The epicenter of the Pac-Man planting.
Yeah.
Do you call it that, or did I just make that up? Okay,
no,
okay.
I invented that term because you kept asking me, how do you walk down?
It's funny because
like,
that's how I just thought about it.
Yeah.
I didn't hear you say Pac-Man.
Yeah.
I was like, it is like the game Pac-Man because
yes.
you're going like back and forth.
Yes. Yeah, so this is an example of like, you know, not perfect. Everything's not perfect.
You're doing the same.
We got some chickweed.
Lots of green sweet. Hey?
Lots of green sweet. It's the fastest and the heaviest.
And exactly.
And
yeah,
we're just now switching. We used to use that red inside, and we just lately been switching to the red.
Red sweet. Yeah.
Yeah.
You use the exact same ones as I do.
Yeah.
Well.
Yeah. And so you can see there's some chickweed pressure in here. So Pac-Man, or just densely planting, whatever you want to call it, Pac-Man tends to be. More of a calculated risk in the spring because the weed pressure can be higher.
Right.
In the fall, which is when we started doing this, it's non-existent, it's flawless. And so
yeah.
most of the photos that we'll put on like our website online, those are fall plants.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? And then spring is some weed pressure. But the other thing that we know about the spring is we're going to be either smothering or tilling right after. And so we just need it to basically be easy enough to harvest. And then we'll deal with it.
Yep.
So kind of easy enough to harvest, and then we'll deal with it. And then this tunnel was the first one planted, so we keep it minimally heated above freezing.
Yep.
And so because we keep it above freezing but below 40 at night, we moved, as soon as we ran out of space in the greenhouse, the first thing we do is we take all the alliums and move them in here. These are all paper pot trays of onions and 4-pack of onions. We move them in here because they don't need really warm temperatures.
Yep.
And we just kind of temporary space.
Yeah.
So just saw horses and purlin type.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
And so once you, are you doing multiple cuts on this, or is it a
in the spring? It depends on yes, we can. But lots of times we've got tomatoes that are busting to get in here, so we do one cut and then we start planting.
Okay.
With one of our hopes with building these new tunnels, is that we'll do a little bit less of that and just getting a second cut. Will be worth a lot to us.
Absolutely.
So this one will be one cut because tomatoes are coming in as soon as we're done. The other tunnel of Salanova that we've got, that'll be two cuts.
So this is like what you said about when this is cut, you come in with that auger.
Yes.
And it's an augery hole. You don't care about the paper chains,
nope.
leftover, whatever.
Nope.
And you just till that stuff in, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, and so our early crops that go in are tomatoes. And our slightly later ones are cucumbers and basil. So the Salanova tunnel that we'll get a double cut from, there's no rush because we'll put the cucumbers and basil in later. The tomatoes we want to get in ASAP.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah. And so we have overhead irrigation in all the tunnels for when it's Salanova or spinach, and then we just run drip when it's
yeah.
tomatoes, cucumbers, and basil.
Yeah. Wow. Like the logistics of Bear Creek, how many people working?
Yeah.
Maybe like how many beds of production are you on a standard 100-foot bed, or because your tractor you're just doing long rows, whatever, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, just talk about
I can
some
give
of those.
The sort of like by the numbers like breakdown.
Yeah.
So full worker wise we're at about 8.
Full time in the season?
Full time in the season, and in the winter there's 4 of us full time.
Yeah.
And part of that is we have work, and part of that is that's our core. I'm counting myself in the 4. Part of that is the 4 of us are like the core management team, and we can do every task on the farm. And so it's part planning, going to conferences together, giving each other vacation time. So it's managing winter. And then we add like 4 in the summer. So basically 8. On the high end, people make like 21 an hour. On the low end, they make 10. 10 is just a short-term apprentice. Any full-time worker starts at $12.50,
yep.
And then for that core team, I've tied. We actually all agreed to tie our salaries together.
Yep.
So I make the same as them.
Wow.
So if one of them wants a raise, all of us need to get a raise, and we go through the budget and look at what's possible. So so we all make $40,000 a year plus bonuses and bennies. So we do that. So that's the workforce, and everybody's local. So we're not doing like, we don't have free interns from a field. You know, everybody's here, even if they're an intern or an apprentice, They're usually from here, either in between high school and college or back for the summer, whatever. And then all the other workers live here. So we have no sort of out-of-state interns, and we have no, like, H-2A workers or any sort of migrant workers or anything like that. So that's the workforce. And historically, payroll has been about, like, 30% of our gross sales. And our hope is that as we pay off some capital debts, that number can creep up. We're not rooting for payroll to go up, but it's one of those things where we really want to take care of our people and grow into our people. And so, you know, I'm not looking at that and saying, oh my God, payroll's way too high. You know, that's how we make money. Mm-hmm. I am on payroll. I get a check deposited into my account. It is not like an owner's draw whenever there's a bunch of money in July. It is very, very consistent. And it's hard to manage the cash flow so that we get the same paycheck in January that we get in July, right? That's really hard. So that's the staff side of things. Growth-wise or sales-wise, we're growing. Last year we did like 410, so about like 410,000.
Gross sales.
Yep, and that was on like a little under 2 acres. So it's pretty high-value production, but a lot of it's like, you know, greenhouse and hoop house stuff. We have a quarter acre in hoop houses.
That's pure square footage.
I'm sorry. Yeah, it's almost more than that.
It's got to be more than that. You got four big.
It's 17,000 square feet. So,
okay.
Yeah, it's closer to 50%.
Yeah, it's almost half acre. Yeah.
Yep. So that's in hoop houses, and then this greenhouse is our only greenhouse. It's 30 by 110, 3,300 square feet. This is the only structure we grow 52 weeks a year in, and halfway down we put up a temporary curtain in the winter, so we're just using the front half and not heating any more than we need to.
Yeah.
Gross sales are right over 400,000 this year. They should be right around like 525,000, something like that. We've grown about 100,000 a year for the last 5 years.
Wow.
And the field production is a really, really smart part of what we do. So we just put the beds where the beds go.
Yeah.
And the field is basically just garlic is the dominant field entity, and our field production is basically always four times the amount of space garlic takes up. Because we're on a four-year rotation.
Yeah.
So this year we have a half acre of garlic, so we plowed some new area so that we have 2 acres total out there. So you've got a half acre for 4 years. Do you follow me?
Yep.
So that's that, and then whatever's not in garlic is basically in Salanova, romaine, kale, and some onions. And that's field production.
You're running this like a scalable business?
We're trying to professionalize the field.
Yep, love it.
Yep, that's the goal. Run it like a business. I mean, and treat it like a business, get respect like a business, and we've won some business awards from our local chamber of commerce.
Cool.
Things like that to me mean a lot because we're trying to do more than just be like Grandpappy's Farm. Like, we're trying to make this a business with decent paying jobs, people that can come to work and have a good job, and it's productive. So it felt really good.
Yeah. And in closing, where should people go to find out more about you guys?
Instagram and Facebook. Instagram for sure.
Yep.
We're just at Bear Creek Organic Farm. We post every day of the week, at least Monday through Saturday, 52 weeks a year.
Yep.
We're pretty accessible. We try to reply to all the comments and, you know, show people parts of the farm.
Yep.
We've learned so much from Instagram from other farmers.
You do.
We love just trying to like put some more information back out there. It's a little bit of a weird hybrid marketing, though, because we're sharing stuff that's interesting to other farmers, but we're really trying to sell to our customers.
Of course.
So we're kind of always towing that line, so we're not getting into, like, soil tests and stuff like that, but we will show people things that are cool.
Yep.
So, Instagram has really benefited our farm. We love that.
Do you guys ever bring, like, you ever do tours or anything
like
that?
Yep, so we have no farm stand, nothing like that, but we do monthly farm tours May through October. And that schedule's on our website. And we've had people drive up here from Ohio and wherever just to come on a tour. And then, you know, if we got time, we'll stay and chat with them or whatever.
Yeah.
We do the tours every month in the evening. We rotate the day. And it's just great. It's just a fun time to go show people the farm. And we have tons of field trips and regular things like that. But, we're in a new era where you can't just do something interesting. You need to show people it's interesting and then tell them why it's interesting and then do it basically every week.
Exactly.
Hey, if you guys like that, make sure to follow them on social media. And I know Brian does tours on the farm. Check out their website. I have all the links below in the show notes. See you in the next video.